Okay, this is an interview with Ken Shapiro. We're here at Steenbach Library inside the University Archives. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program, and today's date is 12-12-12, December 12th, 2012.
Aaron Rodgers Day.
That's right. I guess we should note that the legislature, one of the few things they agreed on, they made today Aaron Rodgers Day. Ken, for sound quality purposes, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Yes, my name is Ken Shapiro, S-H-A-P-I-R-O.
Thank you. As with the last session, you have some notes down on some key things you want to talk about, so I think we'll just let you start. It looks like it's the Corona program you want to start with?
Right.
Okay.
Okay, so the Corona program, spelled K-H-O-R-A-N-A, is named for Har Gobind Khorana, who won the Nobel Prize during his 10 years here at the University of Wisconsin in the biochemistry department. And the Corona program now is a program of student exchange as well as rural development, as well as technology transfer training and industry to industry cooperation between the University of Wisconsin and India. A number of universities and institutions in India with UW, and we've expanded now beyond UW to the CIC schools plus Georgetown and MIT, and we'll be expanding further. So let me give a brief history and talk a little bit more about each element. The program started at a reception for the A-STAR program for students from Singapore. And this is a program that I had exposed to when I visited Singapore with John Wiley and Kim Santiago. Kim was head of International Alumni Affairs. And it turns out that the Singapore government finances their top students to do their undergraduate and then their graduate work any place in the world. And at that time, back in 2006-07, the preceding years, Wisconsin had a large number of these A-STAR students. And after that trip, Kim put on a reception for those students and invited the mentors for the students to the reception. And John Wiley was there, and I was there, and others. And the story, according to Asim Ansari, who was, along with me, the co-founder of the Corona program, let me spell his name, A-S-E-E-M-A-N-S-A-R-I, professor of biochemistry of Indian origin. Asim went up to John Wiley and said, we should have something like the A-STAR program for India. And according to Asim, John said, well, don't talk to me, go talk to Ken Shapiro. So that's how we got started thinking about bringing top Indian students here to UW. I set up meetings with myself and Asim to meet with Joe Elder, the campus's senior Indian expert, and with Gilles Bousquet, campus dean for international affairs, and to let them know what we had in mind. The reception at the Division of International Studies was sort of strange, lack of encouragement and maybe even a feeling of competition since they were also wanting to engage more with India. We started with a pilot program in summer of 2007, bringing three Indian students to UW for a summer of research in biochemistry and related laboratories. And these students, there's been a history probably for more than a dozen years of top students writing to faculty in the States saying, we'd like to come to your lab to do an internship this summer. And faculty, most faculty, have no basis of judging these students. But Asim was able to tease out three good ones. We brought them here in the summer of 2007. And that sort of cut our teeth on how to do that. And we wanted to expand to a full program. So we went and met, by we, I mean myself, Asim Ansari, and Kim Santiago, went to meet with John Wiley to tell him what we were planning to do, which was to develop a large program bringing Indian students here to the U.S. and then following that up with sending UW students to India for these summer research experiences. And our intention was just to inform John, and he floored us all after about 15 minutes at the meeting when he said, "So how much money do you want?" And we had not expected to, and we were not planning to ask him for money. Being unprepared, we stammered around and said, "How about $40,000? And he said, "Okay," which of course left us feeling that we had left money on the table. Mm-hmm. But that was a help. So we used John's money. We also had money from CAL's International Programs, the funding I mentioned last time that was generated by interest from the Kellogg grant that we had. And also before, so we were planning to make a trip to India in January of 2008. Before doing that, we went down to Chicago to meet with Sam Petroda. Sam is based here in Chicago. He is credited as being the man who brought cell phones to India and has been a special assistant to the Prime Minister of India. And he was enthusiastic about the program, and he said something quite wise to us. He said, "You know, Wisconsin's got a great program in biological sciences, biochemistry, biotechnology, et cetera, but so does MIT and Harvard and Stanford and Caltech. But what you guys have that the others don't have is agriculture. And what India really needs is rural development. So whatever you're going to do, please add a rural development component to the program." And as you'll see, we did that. So in January of 2008, Asim and Kim and I went to India, my first time there. I think it was Kim's also. And Kim had, so, and we set up in advance meetings with the Ministry of Science and Technology and several of the top universities, including IIT, the Indian Institute of Technology. There were seven of those. These are special centrally funded universities that are essentially the top science universities in the country. So we had set up a number of meetings, and our first was with the Ministry of Science and Technology. Kim Santiago had notified alumni that we were coming, and we really had just about no connection to alumni. John Wiley had connected us with one alum in Delhi whom he knew from when this person was a student here. We went to the Ministry of Science and Technology, and we were surprised to be met by Krishna Ella, E-L-L-A, who was an alum, actually plant pathology, but most of his work was in microbiology. And Ella has established a very successful pharmaceutical company called Bharat Biotech, B-H-A-R-A-T, which is the Hindu word for Indian. So Ella met us, and it turns out that Ella was close with the Minister of Science and Technology, Kapil Sibal, S-I-B-A-L, first name K-A-P-I-B-A-L. K-A-P-I-L, Sibal, S-I-B-A-L. And so we went with, we didn't expect to see the minister, but with Ella, we were ushered into the minister's office. We talked with him about our plans. We talked with him about some of the experience that we've had in doing similar programs. I talked at length about our programs with China, and that seemed to flip a switch so that the minister said, "Well, we can certainly do as well as you're doing with China," and he said that he'd like to support a program sending about 15 undergraduate science majors from India to UW for summer research experiences. It took us about a year and a half after his decision to finally get it through the Indian bureaucracy. On that trip in January, we traveled to IIT Kanpur, which is considered the top of the seven IITs. We also went to IIT Delhi, IIT Chennai, University of Delhi. Then India has a number of centrally funded science laboratories. National Center for Biological Sciences is considered among the top two. The other one is the Indian Institute of Science, both in Bangalore. We went there and met with the leaders. We met with alumni in Delhi, Bangalore, Mumbai, and also from a prior contact in Chicago, we had been connected with a man who goes by the one name Vishwanathan, V-I-S-H-W-A-N-A-T-H-A-N, publisher of an economic monthly magazine out of Chennai. And there, Vishwanathan had a number of meetings set up at which we were introduced and had conversations with representatives of Mahindra and Mahindra. This, more about this later. Mahindra, M-A-H-I-N-D-R-A. Mahindra and Mahindra is one of the largest industrial conglomerates in the country. One of their branches produces tractors. In fact, they sell tractors in the United States, and they're at some, depending on the year, they are the largest tractor manufacturer in the world. So we also connected with the Indo-US Science and Technology Forum, IUSSTF. That is an organization in India, partly funded by India government and partly funded by the US through monies that were generated from US Food for Peace donations over back in the times when India was very short of food. So that jointly funded institution, they wanted to become part of this emerging Corona program. And in fact, because it took so long to get the Ministry of Science and Technology agreement in place, IUSSTF provided the full funding for the first summer. And this was to bring 15 students to UW for, as I say, about 10 weeks of laboratory research in a variety of departments. And the decision had been made in the Ministry of Science and Technology to focus on biotech. And the departments here were biochemistry, chemistry, nanotechnology faculty and engineering, the bacteriology department here, and related departments on campus, medical school, et cetera. That was a successful summer. We finally did get the agreement with the Ministry of Science and Technology through their Department of Biotechnology, an agreement signed in March of 2009. And prior to that, Kim Santiago, who had at the time been based half a year in Japan, had made connection with Rahul Gandhi, and this is an interesting story, I think. She attended a meeting in Japan that the Japanese government had organized for members of the legislature from India. And Rahul is a member of the legislature from his home area in Amethi in the state of Uttar Pradesh. And at the end of this general meeting, there was an open question and answer period, and Kim said, is anybody, any of you Indian legislators, interested in dairy? And Rahul Gandhi said he was and asked her to come and meet with him afterwards. Rahul Gandhi is perhaps the most popular politician in India. He is the scion of the Nehru, Indira Gandhi, Rajiv Gandhi dynasty. And he is the son of Rajiv Gandhi, who was assassinated, as was his grandmother, Indira Gandhi. And Rahul had his staff meet with Kim, and then they arranged for me to meet with Rahul on a subsequent visit to India, in which we did meet with him, and he was very articulate about the needs for dairy development in his home area in the state of Uttar Pradesh, which is the state just to the east, running east from New Delhi, largest state in India. They say that one out of every nine poor people in the world live in that state in India. So as we proceed, the summer of 2009, we were funded then in part by funds by the Department of Biotechnology and part by the Indo-US Science and Technology Forum. And they split up the cost of airfare and stipends for the 15 students coming to UW. UW chipped in by covering the housing. We charged each of the laboratories that these students were working in $1,000 to cover students' housing expenses. And one of the objectives of the Indian government was to get students more excited about laboratory research. They were finding that the very top students were leaving academia, leaving science, as soon as they got their four-year degree, because they could get big-paying jobs in the IT industry and in the consulting industries, McKinsey, et cetera, operating out of India, and they felt that there was a brain drain internally away from the science research that they needed in the country. So that was one of their objectives for this this program. One of our objectives was to be able to take a look at some of these top Indian students for recruiting them to PhD programs here in Madison and, as it turns out, around the country. And we were successful on both accounts. So it was a very high percentage of the students went on to graduate program, and there's a remarkable number who've come to graduate programs here in the States, and we have, I think, 8 of them here on campus. So the faculty who had these students were very pleased to get such bright students who really pushed ahead the work that of their labs in remarkably short time. So the bottom line is that the students that we were able to get were just terrific. India has so many students that when you deal with the very tip of the pyramid, you're dealing with the very best of the best of the best. And so this was a big plus. And now faculty on this campus, as I'll talk in a minute, across the CIC are asking for more of these students. The program was expanded after the first 3 years. The Department of Biotechnology wanted to expand it, so they're now funding 30 students a year. And the sister department in the ministry, it's called the Department of Science and Technology, this negotiation is underway to add another 40 students funded by them. So that will be up to at least 70, if not close to 100 students in a few years. That's much more than we could handle at Wisconsin. So we first approached the CIC schools. Do I need to explain what that is? Consortium.
Yeah.
It's essentially the Big Ten schools plus Chicago. Stands for the Consortium for Interinstitutional Cooperation, and it's a consortium of those Big Ten plus Chicago schools, and it's, I think, the oldest academic consortium in the country. So we spoke with them about the program, and they seemed eager to join in, as did several other schools. So last year, it was, I think, 6 or 7 schools from the CIC plus Georgetown and MIT, and Cornell wanted to join, but at the last minute they had problems, and it's likely that we've had interest from Cornell, from Harvard, from Caltech, from Berkeley, etc. So it's likely the program will continue to grow, but managed out of Madison. So also the Indian government wanted to tap into the technology transfer expertise that we have here at Wisconsin. And I talked earlier about the Chinese Academy of Sciences having wanted a similar thing. We did programs for them, for some of their science leaders. And so this past summer, we put on a program for science leaders in technology transfer here. And it looks like that will continue to be funded. The Indian government, through IUSSTF, is setting aside some scholarships for UW and US students and it's from the CIC to be funded on their return visits, their reciprocal visits back to India for summer research. So the difficulty seems to be finding enough US and UW students who are ready to take that leap and go spend the summer in India doing research. Conversations have been had with the Fulbright people to see if they want to get involved and help support this. So while we were getting up and running on the student exchange, there was a call for proposals for rural development programs in India. And we put in an application, and it called for partnerships between academia and the private sector in India. So we had those connections that I mentioned before with Mahindra and Mahindra, and also with the through Rahul Gandhi with the Rajiv Gandhi Charitable Trust named for his father. And so we put together a proposal with them and were successful and won $1 million proposal that started in 2009, went for about 2.5 years, I guess it was. And that was to help with dairy development in Uttar Pradesh around the congressional, if you will, district of Rahul Gandhi's area, and also to help Mahindra & Mahindra as they were setting up what they called full-service farm assistance offices throughout the dealerships that they had throughout the country. So we sent one of our soil scientists, John Peters, who spent about 2 years working with Mahindra & Mahindra out of their Mumbai office, but traveling around the country. And then we had squadrons of dairy science experts going out to do training programs and training of trainers in rural and dairy development. We also worked with Vishwanathan on a small NGO that he had out of Chennai. So we fulfilled that objective of including rural development in the program. And those connections, even though the aid money is now finished, the connections continue, and dairy science faculty is still going out there. We recently had conversations talking about setting up a Corona-like program for students focused on field agriculture work rather than bio lab work. We'll see whether that materializes. Let me say that the key to this whole program is Asim Ansari. Asim is one of the highest profile scientists here on campus. He recently won a Romney's Award. He's been a presidential scholar, et cetera. And yet he finds time to devote enormous energies to the Corona program. And it's in part because of his high reputation in India that he has access to the very top scientists and science administrators. So, and since I've retired, he's really been, well, he was the main pusher and certainly is now. So far there's been about 80 to 90 students who've come. I should say with that AID $1 million, there were $3 million of matching funds from the Mahindra & Mahindra and from the Rajiv Gandhi Charitable Trust. Over the period from January 2008 to February 2011, I made 11 trips to India in those roughly 3 years. And I think that's an important note because it indicates what's necessary to get these kinds of programs up and running, both the time and the funding to do that kind of travel. So, any more on the current
Why don't we continue to push forward? So it looks like the next thing on your list, we're moving from Corona program to Land Tenure Center.
Right. So Land Tenure Center was founded here by Ray Penn, P-E-N-N, and Ken Parsons of the Ag Economics Department in 1962. And for many years was the world's leading center for research on land reform, land ownership issues, land tenure, et cetera. Key faculty members from Ag Economics were Ken Parsons, Ray Penn, Peter Dorner, Bill Thiessenhusen, Thiessenhusen, John Strasma, Don Cannell. From other departments, Marion Brown from Ag Journalism, Harvey Jacobs from Urban and Regional Planning were key. Their major focus was work on Latin America, and the funding was almost entirely from USAID. Their funding was not quite what you call a pork barrel, but it was a special allocation from AID each year. My interaction with them was somewhat limited because they were doing quite well without me. My role was largely to visit the congressional delegation and make the case each year that the funding should be continued so that the Congress, our congresspeople, made sure AID kept funding for them. In addition, the center started picking up contract work from AID and also as subcontractors to consulting firms. In 1990, there was a review of the center, and it called for greater integration with the campus, concerned that they were becoming too much like a consulting firm. Faculty interest seemed to be waning, and the center was getting staffed more and more by academic staff who were quite good, but different from long-term tenure track or tenured faculty. So out of that review, I made a request to Cal's administration to provide funding to support two Lantana Center academic staff in moving them into departments to have a teaching role in those departments, and also funding to provide a small grants program that the center could reach out to faculty across the campus in small grant competition. So we got about $100,000 from the college to do that. Then AID changed its funding procedures and created another collaborative research support program, CRISP, with the acronym of BASIS. I can't recall what that means, but it's got something to do with assets. The Lantana Center, led by Bill Thiessenhusen, proposed for that, for leadership of that CRISP, and was successful. And that became a basis of a lot of funding for the center. Bill retired, has since passed away, and the leadership went to Michael Roth, a staff member. And at the time, after Bill left, I think it was John Bruce, another staff member, was director of the center. Michael Roth decided at one point, finally, that he did not want to take the leadership anymore of the BASIS CRISP, and no one in the center did. So since it was a UW project, it rested with me, and I offered it to Michael Carter, a faculty member in Ag Economics, and Michael accepted and took it and ran with it and did a wonderful job. Unfortunately, Michael has since left for UC Davis, and that project will go with him at the end of this year, I guess. He left a couple of years ago, but it's been in transition. 10 years after that first review, I think it was about 2001 actually, there was a second review, and then the center by that time seemed to be in difficulty. We could not get any faculty member to take on the directorship, and faculty involvement overall had seriously declined. So we were struggling with how to sort of rejuvenate the center. And at the same time, one of the many budget cuts that the university suffered came down, and the college administration, I guess it was Dean Avely, decided that this was one place where he could save money, so he withdrew that $100,000 support that had been going to the center. And the decision was made to close the center. The decision was made by Cal's. The center staff protested, there were hearings, et cetera, and the decision by Provost Speer was to keep the center open, but to phase out any funding from the university. And so, and the college decided that it did not want to be having the responsibility for the center. So eventually it migrated to the Nelson Institute, where it still is alive and has, I think now mainly is essentially running a seminar series. The Lantana Center name had been famous throughout the world, and you know, perhaps in the future interest by faculty will will increase, and the center will get back to its glory days.
Okay. One of the things I wanted to ask you that you have on your list is you sort of returned to teaching after a while here, and you want to talk about the specifically one class.
Okay, so for, I think it was starting in the mid to early 90s, I took over a course called World Hunger. Well, I expanded it to World Hunger and Malnutrition, which is redundant, of course, but it does give a bigger view of what the course is about. And it's a cross-listed course between agronomy, agricultural applied economics, nutritional science, and Cal's interdisciplinary course. So, and its number is 350. The course was started in the 1970s. I believe it was Jerry Dahl from agronomy and Dan Geisler from engineering. Dan had been active in Bread for the World. And this was a time in the 70s when there was a world food crisis, in part sparked by the oil embargo, the OPEC oil embargo in the 70s, and the big droughts in the West Africa. It was, I gather, team taught for a while, and then it was picked up by Joanne Chetta, C-S-E-T-E, assistant professor in nutritional sciences. And she had it for about five or six years she was on campus, from the late 80s to the early 90s or mid 90s. Joanne was absolutely terrific faculty member, PhD in nutrition and economics out of Cornell, a lot of experience in Africa, especially in the Congo. And I think she just became impatient with academia. So she left and joined first the United Nations, UNIFEM, the women's program, and then she joined Human Rights Watch. And she then became a faculty member, tenured faculty member at the Columbia School of Public Health. I guess before that she headed up a, an AIDS organization in Canada. So she was terrific, and she was teaching the course. And then she left, and I was asked if I would pick it up, and I did. I had taught a small seminar on the topic back in Michigan in the 70s. And the course essentially takes, in the first part of the course, a broad overview of the dimensions of global hunger, and then zeroes in looking at agriculture production, looking at population, looking at inequality problems, and then a series of policies and programs to alleviate hunger. Started with about 35 students, and eventually it grew to between 200 and 300 students, depending on whether we would have two or three TAs available. There were no TAs early on. It's the kind of course that students like. As an interdisciplinary course, it could draw students from many departments. And it, in the early days, I think it was a very good course with fewer students. With that small number of students, we did a lot of extra things. So I encouraged students to bring to the class materials that they found particularly interesting, that gave insights into problems of hunger around the world. So we would have student readings. Students would stand up and read from texts that they had discovered. We would play simulation games, one looking at hunger problems in the West African Sahel. That's that area just south of the Sahara. Another looking at a poverty simulation in the US. We would have group poster presentations. I took a group down to Auburn, where there was a national program getting started to organize students around the country to work with the United Nations, what is it called, World Food Program. So we were able to do those kinds of things with the small class. At some point, I was inviting faculty from nutritional sciences to bring in as guest lecturers more about the biology of malnutrition. And one of those was Julie Thurlow, T-H-U-R-L-O-W. Julie's actually an academic staff lecturer. And she was so good that I asked her to continue. And by the time I finished teaching the course, we had split the course so that Julie did a third of the course on the biology of malnutrition. I guess that's been about 10 years now already. And then I did the two-thirds on the topics that I mentioned. The demand for the class started growing, and in part it grew not only because of the wonderful professors, of course, but the topics were of interest, but also it fulfilled the biology requirement for LNS students, and it was a biology requirement that didn't require them to do lab work. So we made a decision early that we, Julie and I, that we wanted as many students exposed to this material as possible. We thought it was important for them as educated citizens. So we tried to expand the class. And with just the two of us, we expanded it to 100, but still had an equal number who wanted to get in. And then CALS was able to secure some TAs through the MIU program, and then had an open competition across the college for TAs. And by this time I was chairing Ag Economics. And so in our department, we put in a proposal for TAs, and we won two for that course, as well as others for other courses. So that allowed us to expand to 200 students. And then in, I guess, a couple of years, we were able to snag a third TA, so we expanded it to 300, and there was still a waiting list. So, but I think the course, I didn't like the course when it was that big, and I think student satisfaction with the course declined as well. But that's the price you pay for big courses, I guess. Mm-hmm. So now John Paul Chavaz has taken over the course. He'll teach it for the first time this spring, and Julie Thurlow will continue. John Paul is a faculty member in Agriculture and Applied Economics.
Okay. And I guess that sort of segues into what you want to talk about next, right?
Right. Okay. So I was chair of the Department of Agricultural Economics, Agricultural and Applied Economics, from July of 2009 through June of 2012. I was surprised that Brad Barham asked me to be chair, because I had been in the department, but not of the department, so I say, really spending my time in, as associate dean, and we'll talk about that transition later. When I was invited to do that, I thought it was sort of strange. But Brad said that the department was unable to come to agreement on a chair from within the more active members of the department. And I knew about the some of the acrimony that had been in the department before Brad's time, and some still continuing. So the first thing I did was call the two largest players on the different sides of that acrimony, Dan Bromley and Ed Jesse, both of whom I was quite close with, even though they held rather opposing views about what the department should be. Both of them were quite enthusiastic about my taking this on, so I agreed to put my name in, and the faculty voted to have me as chair. And one positive that was cited was that because I was something of an outsider, I would be somewhat of a calming influence. That proved to be the case. I held one-on-one interviews with all the faculty to get acquainted with some new ones and reacquainted with others. Got a big help from the department secretary, Kathy Martin Taylor, who led me through the procedures that I was not cognizant of. I leaned heavily on the personnel committee in the department. We started right off the bat to have weekly coffees that I instituted, which were a nice low-pressure way of socializing for all faculty, staff, and students, with volunteers rotating, bringing in treats and such like that. And that's continued now into its fourth year. I held weekly lunches with the five relatively new faculty members, Laura Schechter, Jen Alex Garcia, Guanming Shu, SHI, Brent Hewitt, and Paul Mitchell, to learn what they thought about the department as coming in from, you know, within the last 5 years. A lot of what I did was recruiting, and that speaks to what had happened with the department. The department had been renowned for its work in international development and natural resource / environmental economics. And by the time I came in, that large resource environmental economics group had withered away to just 7/10 of one faculty member. There had been retirements of Dan Bromley, Rich Bishop, David, whose last name I'm forgetting, and then Bill Preventure cut back to 30%. So from about four faculty, we were down to 7/10 of one faculty member. And as I said, that was one of the pillars of the department. The department essentially has three groupings: international development, resource economics, and economics of agriculture, which focuses mostly domestically. The two highest reputation groups are the development and natural resources. although the by far the most famous faculty member in the department is in what we call economics of agriculture, and that's Jean-Paul Chavaz. So we were able in the 3 years I was there to reconstitute that resource economics program. Before I arrived, Brad Barham had won a position from CALS to recruit for a resource economist, and that recruiting took place during my first year, and we got an assistant professor, Corbett Granger, and that started an education for me about salaries. It turns out that economists are well paid compared to their peers and other departments in this College of Agriculture and across the country, i.e. the salaries are higher in ag economics departments than in agronomy or horticulture, soils, etc. And so it was a struggle for me to get a salary competitive enough to get Corbett to come. Corbett Granger comes out of one of the best resource economics programs out of the University of UC Santa Barbara and had other offers, but we were able to get him a salary of $99,000, which was starting with the base that the college had thought about of $80,000, which they were offering to incoming assistant professors at the time. So that was my first struggle with the central administration. Then the campus started the Madison Initiative for Undergraduates and invited faculty across the campus to put in proposals. And we put in a proposal to strengthen the resource economics program even further. You know, we indicated we've just hired or about to hire an assistant professor. We've got another 7/10 of a senior person we need. And we proposed for two more. And that proposal was a team effort. I was helped a lot by Ian Coxed, who's now the new chair, Barbara Forrest, an outstanding academic staff member in the department, Marin Bozic, graduate student, and others. And we submitted our proposal and were not selected in the first round, but were encouraged to go for a second round. And we were successful at that time. In fact, we were ranked second out of, I think it was 100 proposals from around the campus. And we got all the funding that we asked for, with one exception. So we got funding for two faculty, one senior and one junior, and I should say one associate, one at the associate level, one at the assistant or associate level. We got funding for two full-year TAs, funding for 25% student internship coordinator, and I think it was about $18,000 of miscellaneous funds for travel and support of the program. We had asked for funding, scholarship funding for interns, but the MIU didn't grant that. So we set out to do our recruiting, and again we had to struggle to get salaries up to a reasonable level. The senior faculty member, I think, came in at about 120, which was very high for associate professor. And the assistant professor came in, I think, at 105. And he was the most recent hire. But there was a difficult problem that arose, and I think it's worth telling the story. Molly John, the dean at that time, had been away for a year in USDA and then came back. And she declared that we should not be recruiting two faculty members, but just one, since we had just hired Corbett Granger prior to the MIU. And when we showed her the proposal and told her that, in fact, our proposal stated that we were having that assistant hire and we were proposing for two more, she said no, she was going to take back one of those positions and keep them in CALS for other purposes. And she said that, she told me and others, that she had spoken with Irwin Goldman, who was the acting dean while she was away, and that Irwin told her that, yes, that was the understanding, that we would give one of those back to the college. When I approached Irwin and asked him about that, he said that he had never had any discussion with Molly about this, and he sent me copies of email correspondence between him and Aaron Brower, who was the head of the MIU, in which the two of them confirmed to each other that they understood that after we were awarded that MIU, that this was for two new positions in addition to the position that we had gotten Cal's permission to recruit for, the Granger position. So the provost overruled Molly, and we were able to go after and recruit the two faculty members. And I take it from comments by other faculty and other administrators that this episode with Dean John was not an isolated incident and evidently led to the provost calling for the review of her position a year early, and after that review, dismissing her from her deanship. We were also able to expand resource economics through two other venues. One, the Bioenergy Institute had funding for new faculty positions, and one of those was to be in social sciences. So we competed for that and were successful and brought in Sheldon Du, DU. And he was an expert in bioenergy. The additional position came our way really by no major effort by us, but just by good happenstance. The Wisconsin Institute for Discovery was staffing up, and the way WID is set up is that they can recruit and pay salary for faculty, but they can't provide a tenure home. And one of their top three people that they wanted to recruit said that if he were to come to Wisconsin, he'd like to be in our department. And that was a person named Tom Rutherford. And Tom was world famous for his work on energy and climate change and what they call computational economics. And we were delighted with that. He came, he was interviewed, and ultimately he was their top choice. And he interviewed with us, and our faculty was delighted to make him an offer as well. And there, again, the salary is a remarkable issue. Tom took a salary cut. He was at the Institute of Technology in Zurich, which is the same place that Einstein got his PhD. He took a salary cut to come here for $180,000. And that's an indication of how economics faculty salaries have just skyrocketed. And it's a problem in colleges of agriculture, because essentially I think it's a domino effect. Business school faculty are getting very high offers. Economics department faculty are getting very high offers, less than business school. And it's coming down to ag economics faculty also getting very high offers, so that the salary structure in our college is a little unusual because of that. So that was a major set of activities that I had when I was chair. The other was retaining faculty. It seemed like every time a faculty member would come into my office, I would steel myself to be told that they were getting an offer from elsewhere. So we had retention and ultimately successful to keep people, Brad Barham, Jeremy Foltz, Ian Coxhead, Paul Mitchell, Laura Schechter. We should have been able to retain her. She's absolutely top-notch development economist. And we lost her to Michigan State. And here again, the salary was over. She was making something like $77,000. They offered her $110,000 at Michigan State. And we lost her, but then we were able to get her back. So we got her back, I think, at about $120,000. But with the economics department picking up 10%, we had a joint appointment now for her, which is, I think, the first one of those. We also had to retain Bruce Jones. Randy Fortenberry came to us and said that he had an offer from Washington State University. And this was one case where we really did not make a major effort to retain Randy. We made a small offer, but Randy had had a retention offer 3 years earlier. And also, Randy had been the head of the Rank Agribusiness Institute, and there were a lot of unhappiness with the way that institute was run, how it was spending its money, how it was not integrated with the department. The Renk Agribusiness Institute runs on an endowment of $2 million from the Renk family as part of the Department of Ag and Applied Economics. So Randy left, and I think personally that on net that was a good thing for the department. And we was the spark that allowed us to reorganize the Renk Agribusiness Institute, another major undertaking. Got Dean's approval for new operating principles that had the department and the institute working more closely together in a cooperative way. Bruce Jones applied for and won the competition to become the new director, and is doing an excellent job, and in fact got an extra $1 million endowment from the Renks already in his first 6 months as the director. So I think that was on net a plus for the department. There was a new curriculum committee created during my time, and it just started actually operation after I left. And it's taking a comprehensive look at the grad and undergraduate curriculum, and I think doing a good job. The department is interesting in a way that it has a very large demand for its courses in international development and in resource and environmental economics. We're the only place on campus that teaches the economics of both of those fields. And the courses are good, and students demand them. We get large enrollments, but relatively few majors. And when we talk to students about that, they say two things. One, I didn't know that you did this. You know, with a name like Ag and Applied Economics, I was not aware that this is where this subject was taught, and they don't become aware of it until they're juniors, by which time it's hard for them to change majors. Second, they say, the name of your department is just too strange for what I want to do. I want to work in environmental economics, I want to work in international development, but your department's name is Ag and Applied Economics, which doesn't tell prospective employers what I want to do. So there's always been discussions about changing the name. The name had been changed from Agricultural Economics to Ag and Applied with some difficulty. The economics department was not happy about that change. The original proposal was just Applied Economics, and they clearly did not want that. So that's maybe more of an issue for the department if the campus goes to an enrollment-based funding strategy rather than a what do you call legacy funding. So you know, this department has a high credits follow instructor ranking, but not a high majors ranking within the college. That may prove difficult. So my involvement in the department, actually I had agreed to do three years, but after 2 years, Governor Walker was threatening the supplemental health insurance program. I decided I should retire. And then I was asked to stay on for a third year, so I became what was called a double dipper. I retired and came back for that last year. It was a good experience for me. I enjoyed it. I think the department was happy, well, at least that's what I've been told. Upon retiring, there was a nice retirement party. I got the college's Distinguished Service Award, nice ways to end my time. I should give kudos. I mentioned Barbara Forrest is a great staff person, and Kathy Martin Taylor is a great staff person, also Terry Whipperforth, who was the administrator of the department that I hired. The other one had left just as I was coming in. Just three terrific staff people, and there are others as well. Also want to give kudos to Steve Stern, who was associate vice chancellor or something like that. Steve was important for me to get advice from him about being a chair. He holds monthly meetings with chairs across campus, and he's the one who was in back of designing these salary exercises, higher salary increments for promotion, post-tenure compensation, high-demand compensation. So through these various mechanisms, we were able to get a raise for every one of our faculty members during my 3 years, even though there was no comprehensive pay plan. And Steve gets the credit for that. So
And so now it looks like the last thing on your list is the changes in cows?
Right.
Okay.
So I could do that.
Yeah, let's do that.
Okay. So I think I mentioned that when I arrived, there had not been a strong tradition of seeking or competing for grants through the Office of International Programs. Rather, the office ran on programs that were generated by MUSEA, the Midwest University Consortium for International Activities, essentially Big Ten again, and some AID automatic funding for colleges of agriculture. And my whole orientation was to go after external funding, and Dean Walsh hired me because he and I agreed that that was something we should do, and he was very encouraging for that. And we've talked about the various projects, so we were quite successful in going after those funds. The staff expanded when I came. It was a staff of 4.5 FTE and grew to about 11, sometimes more depending on the projects that we had that might require additional staff support. Important to note is that in all that time, we only had funding for 2.5 FTEs from the state. So all the rest of that was soft money generated from external grants and contracts, et cetera. There had not been a study abroad program, and we started that with the Trinidad program that I talked about before. And the after, I don't know, maybe 10 years, the Office of International Programs in the college got to be relatively high profile across campus and well networked across campus. So for example, when Chuck Irish from the law school wanted to start his East Asian Legal Studies program, he came to us to talk about how we ran things. When Cindy Hack was involved in getting the Center for Global Health started, she came to us to talk about, to get advice on how to get things rolling. We had a close collaboration with the Engineering College on a Chilean Scholars Program, joint programs with the School of Business, study abroad programs with them, links with the area studies programs, especially Africa when I first came, and then CRECA, the Russian Center for Russian and East European Studies, then East Asia and South Asia. So it was a large, well-connected, high-profile program with a continuous flow of about $1 million a year in projects, new projects starting every 1 or 2 years. There were close connections developed with departments. We created an international committee that had a representative from each department and an active representative, i.e. there were assignments for them to work within their departments. There was strong support from Dean Walsh and Dean Averly, especially. Dean John had a different idea. She wanted to shrink the international office, and she did. So it's now back to, I think, 3 FTEs headed by my former assistant, John Ferrick, who's a very good man, but it's a much smaller operation. So she made the following decisions. She moved the Babcock Institute out of international programs over physically to the Dairy Science Department. She moved semester study abroad programs up to Bascom's International Academic Programs Office. She moved the Big China IGRT program over to agronomy. Since I had told her I was planning to retire when I was 67 and other staff were retiring, she made that a point of having me leave and having the other staff not be replaced, so that the program shrank rather rapidly. I gather from John that she had discouraged going after large, well, even before that, she discouraged going after large programs centered within the Office of International Programs. She wanted it to be more of a department-centered and entrepreneured and managed set of operations. The departments disagreed with this. This international committee actually came to her and put out a proposal saying that they wanted to see a strong central office continued to build on the expertise of the staff, the synergy amongst the different programs, the connections out across the campus, and the ability to deal with large-scale, multi-department projects. But she didn't see it that way. So now the office is, as I say, quite small. Its major activity is the short-term study abroad programs that, like the Uganda program I mentioned, they play a role in administering the Corona program, et cetera. And the college is going through its strategic planning exercise now, and one of the issues is what the new dean's vision for international programs should be. So started out small, grew big, and now is small.
Small again. So, maybe just a couple more things. I guess first off, one of the things I'm always interested in is change over time, and you just sort of laid that out for international programs. But specifically, I'm wondering what sort of changes, if any, that new technologies, particularly sort of the change from into the more digital world, affected your program, or did it affect your program?
Well, one of the things was the Learn at UW website that the kids use. And so, you know, first there was the shift from my so I'm focusing on teaching now. Started off with transparencies and just with standard lecture notes and talking to the class. And then PowerPoint came along. And so I shifted to that. And then kids said, well, why aren't you posting those on Learn at UW? And I think that was a progressive degeneration in my teaching anyway. And I guess others have been able to make use of that technology to improve their teaching. But for me, it meant less and less connection with the students. And I didn't like that, and I think the students didn't like that. So I can't blame the technology, as I say, because others have been able to make good use of it. And for me, it proved to be a negative. You know, it presents opportunities. We, from time to time, would have inquiries from students at other universities who would want to be able to sign on, and we were able to do that in a couple of cases to plug them into the Learn at UW website too. And so that's a class that, if John Paul and Julie are so inclined, would be one to look at for a MOOC, massive online open course, if the university decides to go that way.
One other thing I wanted to ask, and this I think kind of ties to the rise in technology, and you alluded to this, I believe, when you said that you made, during the Corona program, you made at least a dozen trips, close to a dozen trips to India. So even with the rise in digital technology, do you feel it important to have
to be there,
you face to face?
Yeah, and I'll give you a little story. One part of the Corona program was the rural development dimension, and part of that was working on dairy development out in the state of Uttar Pradesh, and this is way out in the boondocks. I mean, you fly on a puddle jumper to Ludhiana, and then you get in the Land Rover and you drive for 2.5 hours out to the rural area where we were based. And this was under the aegis of the Rajiv Gandhi Charitable Trust. And Rahul Gandhi was the director of that. It's a trust in his father's name. And the director of the program, the dairy, well, it was a women's self-help program, of which our dairy training was part. The director of that program, a young man named Sampath Kumar, is that his last name? K-U-M-A-R. So about half the time of those 11 trips, I would spend time out in the boondocks with him, and the rest of the time I'd be in the capital city and such, you know, or at universities negotiating. And I don't know, it was my third or fourth trip out there, and Sampath said to me, you know, Ken, a lot of people come to visit us out here because of Rahul Gandhi, but you're the only one who keeps coming back. And that said a lot to me, and what he was saying was that it showed that the university really was interested in a long-term relationship. And I found that, you know, you can do a lot with email, but unless you're there to sit down and talk and go have lunch and have tea, et cetera, and visit for a day or so and then go off someplace else and come back for a follow-up visit during the same 2 weeks that you're in the country, that makes a huge difference. So a travel budget and the time to do that travel is really quite important. So, you know, the technology is nice. You know, you could send an email to India during our daytime. They're 11 and a half hours off. They'll pick it up in the nighttime and respond, so you'll have it the next morning. But it just doesn't work with emails. And, you know, Asim, he goes back. He continues to go back. He's going to be there for almost a month as soon as classes end, negotiating for the extension I mentioned with the Department of Science and Technology. You know, and it was the same, you know, more recent, you know, there was the Mexico program, there were the Uganda programs. You know, we had email, we had Skype, but you really needed to visit. And again, it may be just that I'm too old and I'm not taking advantage of the technology the way I didn't in my teaching, but. There it is. Well, similarly, you know, this technology transfer course where they, you know, the Chinese back in the about 2000, the Chinese sent 20 of their research leaders for a couple of years. And now the Indians are starting to do the same. So you'd say, well, why can't we run the course by Skype or something like that, or telepresence? And in fact, Asim was able to do some telepresence back and forth with people in India, Skyping to the Indians who were here in residence, but they really needed to be here to talk with the rich breadth of people involved with tech transfer here, to be able to go to the research park and talk with the leaders of some of the new companies there. Mm-hmm. So there are limits to what you can do with the technology.
One last thing. So you officially retired in 2011?
Right.
And then you had a year where you were still head of the department.
Right, so I was hired back. Surprised everybody that an emeritus professor could be the department chair, but the rules allowed that. if you have 20% appointment and the department votes you full privileges, then you can function as any faculty member.
What other, if any, activities on campus have you been involved in?
So, you know, I'm still asked to come meet with John Ferrick, who's been a good friend for a long time, about issues coming up in international programs. Asim Ansari would like me to continue as active as ever with the Corona program, which I don't feel I can or should do. So I'm back and forth to meetings with especially the two of them. Similarly with Ian Coxhead, the new department chair. So I've got a little office up on the fourth floor near his office so that he can come and chat if there are issues. So it's mostly sort of an extended handing off to the people I was most involved with, John Ferrick, Asim Ansari, the new department chair in Ag and Applied Economics. I was up meeting with Guido Podesta just last week about the Corona program. He's the new acting dean for international programs in campus. So there's that. But then the fun thing I'm doing is sitting in on classes. So good friends, Richard Knowles, K-N-O-W-L-E-S in English department, and Joe Elder in sociology, agreed to my proposal that I be allowed to sit in the back row and listen in on their lectures. Dick teaches Shakespeare, and Joe teaches cultures of modern India. So I've spent this semester, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, in those two classes. And as long as I'm allowed to do that, I think I'd continue to do that.
Okay. So, Ken, anything else you want to add?
No, I think that's a lot.
Okay.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Well, and I appreciate the time, all the time you've given me over these few sessions. So thank you very much.
Welcome.